Ray, thank you for cooperating and reconfiguring ourselves. And as I mentioned, this is really dialogue that we have in mind. So it's no simple Q&A. Obviously, we have questions. We'd like to have answers to that. We have discovered in this process that's been going on for a couple of months now, there are no simple answers to the complex questions that have been raised here and the complex questions that you will be able to raise. So the task that we have another hour, an entire hour, available for doing this, with the exception of 5 minutes at the end that we'll ask Diana to do a brief wrap-up. We'd like to identify questions, issues, and concerns that you have in regard of everything that you heard. So do interact with the content of what we try to expose you to. But on the other hand, we also don't want to lock you in. If you see issues and questions and concerns that go beyond what we were developing here, that's fine. The major question that we raised, the changing learning landscape, the fact that there are learners in there, I think that's sufficiently broad to give everyone the opportunity to say something about it. So interacting with the content and additional insights that we like to develop and with a longer run perspective, there's also an interest on our part for people who are interested in this idea to come forward, identify themselves, say, hey, you didn't invite me, I should have been part of this game, and can I join at a later stage, because this is going on, and either any of you who are here, or people that you may know and bring it to their attention, they'll be most welcome to participate. So I stop here, and the floor is open.
Yeah. Well, it strikes me, one of Michael's comments, that the invisible learners online are really not any different than the invisible learners that are visible to us in the classroom. And I can think of a number of examples of my students who I've said, I'm going, you know, these folks are brain dead when I'm sitting there, and yet they end up coming up with either very innovative comments or, I don't say a word throughout an entire course, and create wonderful works. So it may be more, and I think you're along the right line, that it has more to do with the learning style and the way our students or anybody processes and interacts with information and other people than necessarily the format.
Thank you for that observation. Again, it's obviously triggered by Michael's comments, but not necessarily directed at him, and anyone who would like to interact with that observation and with Michael's presentation, please feel free to continue. Leah?
Okay, I have a number of observations. So the first one is with that. You know, I fully agree with you, but I think in this session we focus on the learner, and I know that was the objective, but I feel we can't separate the learner from the instructor. I think that so they are linked, really, and it's very difficult to talk about the learner. We don't think about the instructor. So you said we have to use the technology, but my question is, do we have the competent instructor? And I think you talked about, for instance, what are my students missing? Now, I think my students are missing what I'm doing now to Mike.
Oh, I love it.
Yes. it is the affection that you can show, you know? We get all the smiles, kisses, and I don't know what from our students. It's not that. Is it, Mike?
Do it again.
But I think this is very, very important. And I really think we have to think about the communication skills of not only of the students, but of the instructors. Because so many of us, I think we said the standard answer, as one of you mentioned, I think. Yeah, you mentioned that, John. That, okay, you sent the standard question, for instance, for an assignment or something like that, or where are you? But I think if you were in the class, you wouldn't do that. You would say, hey, John, I haven't heard from you, what's up, etc. So I feel that there's a problem. The second, then I go on to Mike, the visible student. You know, I once dropped out of the course because there were so many visible students. And I'm a rather, although not tall, a rather visible person. But you know what happened in these courses, what I saw was so many people were talking and talking. It was a course, in fact, to be very honest, I dropped out twice. Same course, I did 21 courses, and I dropped out of two courses, and it was the same course with Tony Bates of all people, because, you know, the quality was not taken into consideration. People chatted and chatted and chatted, and I had to read all this to be a visible student. So I think what you all has already mentioned, I think the quality aspect is very important. And lastly, to get Michael Moore with us, Michael Moore once said that you can have an initially mediocre student or learner, a lousy course, and an excellent instructor. The result is likely to be a success. But if you have it the other way around, and you have a rather good student, a rather good course, and a lousy instructor, the result may be a disaster. So I think that is my point. We should really not separate the actors in the whole process, but we should take them, all of them, into consideration. Thank you. Sorry for talking so long.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Michael, because you just verified my own lurking behavior. I hate online discussions.
You mean I validated it?
You validated it, yeah, this was good.
I didn't say I was necessarily endorsing.
I knew, yes, I accepted it as an endorsement. I'm working at BYU Hawaii, and I'm in an area where we're trying very hard to get this small residential liberal arts college to think of themselves to reach out. We reject 88% of the students that apply to our university, most of these members of the Mormon Church, and we would like to be able to accommodate more of these students, but we have very limited physical facilities. And so one of the goals that our Board of Trustees said, we'd like you to reach out. Now, I'm in on the ground floor, so I'm facing the number one problem, and that is there's a whole faculty of liberal arts professors who are not the least bit interested in online instruction. And so it's a big challenge from that standpoint. But I'd like to raise the other issue. Our students come from 80 different foreign countries. Most of our student body are from Asia and the Polynesian Islands. When we put a course online, we have probably as much diversity as exists anywhere. And this diversity includes language. Although the courses are all in English, and we expect our students to learn in English, as you well know, as you well know, when students speak English as a second language, even when their language skills are good, this is a significant handicap unless they've been in an English-speaking country for some time. In addition to the language, we have tremendous cultural differences. If I have students from Japan, Korea, and the big cities in China, I have very motivated students. If I have students from the Polynesian Islands, they may show up twice in 2 weeks because, you know, it's a warm day, why do I want to come? Tremendous differences in learning styles, all the way from the very memorized, to the kind of casual, whatever works for I need for picking coconuts, you know, kind of a thing. So I guess one of the other issues I'd like to raise, and certainly your own raised that issue in terms of looking at the individual students, this poses a tremendous challenge when we start to try to design and figure out how to interact with these students. So I'd like to put that on the table because, you know, I assume all of us have that to some extent, but I suppose we have it probably as it's just given in our situation, and we've had long debates about that. Just one other point in that, the University of the South Pacific is primarily an online university. I don't know how many of you are familiar with it. 14 different countries, island countries, are involved in the consortium. And they made a decision some time ago, and most of their distance ed is print-based. It's not really online per se. They're moving to more online. But they made a decision a long time ago, if you can't handle the language, we don't want you as a student, which I think limits. But we haven't got that luxury, because our luxury is if they're members of our community, we want to provide the education to them. So I throw that out as a, I don't have an answer. I just have a big question to put on the table.
Thank you, Dave, for that. I know the names of some people, so I didn't ask them to identify themselves, David Merrill, Leah Visser, and Wes Miller. But perhaps we should just make it a rule, identify yourself when you speak.
Rocky Lupicini, Concordia University, has been my job, and I'm one of your interns this year. I have a comment and a question. First, the idea of this online interaction and how reflective learners offline are often reflective learners online is something that I came to also in teaching this year. And I have a high proportion of international students in my class who came to me at the very beginning, as they do every year, saying, you know, I know we have class participation marks, can we get rid of it or find another way because I'm not comfortable expressing myself in class. So I said, instead of passing the buck, I said, okay, we're going to divide it up and we'll have web CT, we'll have a lot of online discussions. But then they continued to be very reflective, ended up with very high marks at the end, very excellent, hardworking students. So I was thinking along the same things, and I was really happy I came this morning just to have a little bit of confirmation on that. It's not that they're slackers, it's just that it's an attribute of their learning style. The second point is a question. I heard the term mass individualization, and the question I'm asking is that one of the directions we want to go in, or is it the direction we want to go in? And the reason I ask is that on the one hand, well, we have a dichotomy. On the one hand, we have individual learning styles to take into consideration, very important. On the other side, we don't want too much chatter online, as Dr. Weiser indicated. I'm killing myself going through the online discussions. When I look to people like Carlo Opel, Habermas, John Searle, they set up discourse competencies, and they do a very good job of doing so. And I've incorporated that into my classes. So before we start at the front end, we have, I said, this is how we want to interact online. Here are some of the competencies, the discourse competencies that will translate perhaps into learning competencies, or at least have an effect on that. And it might affect performance. I don't know at this stage. But the idea is that they go in with an understanding, a better understanding of how to create a learning conversation online so that they get the most out of the group interaction. So instead of catering only to individual learning styles, we're also trying to create a normative framework. So the question I ask is, do we want to go in one direction or both directions? Do we want to emphasize individual, mass individualization, or do we also want to create some normative framework at the front so we can maximize efficiency and effectiveness when we're having online discourse, so we can come a little closer to the Habermasian dream of this rationalization of how we interact with one another online?
You're asking the question seems to suggest that you're looking for a good compromise.
A middle ground, or pursuing both perhaps different groups, maybe mm-hmm. different groups for advanced learners and lifelong learners, as opposed to middle school, that sort of thing.
Well, thanks for raising that question. There may be people who would like to react to that question.
Well, I have a question related to what was your name again?
Rocky. Yes.
Okay. Rocky. No, it has to do with this discourse competencies. One of the things I heard echoed that we talked about within the group was hit hard by your run at the very end. The big differences really weren't online face-to-face, right. But it had to do with these, you find invisible, and Michael said it too, invisible learners in both these contexts. The discourse competencies then, and what you learned from these other folks, is that specific to online? Or is that a competency that would apply to learners in all of these contexts? You could just give a quick response. I see John jumping up.
Simple answer for me is it is no. I'm simply incorporating this into my course because I'm dealing with the situation. And the situation is I have international students who weren't very comfortable interacting in class. So I turned the class into a hybrid class, so we did half of it online, so I could cater to my students, because that's where my primary concern is, to reach out to my students and give them what they need.
But Michael made the point that he's actually learned a lot more about teaching face-to-face from the online experience. I thought I heard you say that.
I didn't say necessarily more, but it has been instructive.
Yeah, so would some of that cross over back to your face-to-face class? Would you adopt some of these same techniques now that you saw the need explicit in the online environment? Would some of that actually inform what you do face-to-face?
I'm assuming yes. That's my belief. But I want to test this out for a few years. And I'm quite young, and I just started teaching. So it'll be maybe 5 or 6 years.
We thought I was the same age as Dave.
I thought I was the same age as Dave.
But we can't say enjoy it. You'll be get all facts.
You're already starting to gray.
Rita. From Wayne State. I think that we're dealing with a lot of the demand for this overt interaction is dealing with our own inadequacies. I think what we want is engaged students. And that's very difficult to really measure. I mean, I would be happy if people were sitting there thinking all the time and coming up with new ideas and so forth. And it's difficult to measure engagement and figure out what that is without reaching out for, you know, if somebody says something, then you can say, okay, there, I've got proof of it, and I don't know how. That's the overall thing. If we knew academic engagement, then I think we could broaden this.
I think in one way would be...
Can you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Andy Gibbons from Utah. From
Utah.
One of the things that I think we're doing is being peripheral to the real question that we've come to discuss. We're really interested in instruction. And a place for the beginning of instruction discussions ought to be, what is the nature of instruction? My personal opinion is that it's a kind of conversation that takes two agents somehow involved, two or more agents involved in the conversation. And so one of the things that we ought to do is be talking in terms of the conversation. Some of Yaron's remarks indicated the mass customization issue. I'm more interested in the customization issue first, and then figuring out how we can conduct a conversation with the silent learner or the invisible learner. That's at the pace and at the size of communication chunk that they're comfortable with. It takes them a little while longer to communicate, to accumulate something they feel is worth communicating. They may not feel, some people don't feel as comfortable communicating as other people do. Some people, it just rolls off their tongue. I have a son-in-law who's just a one big one-liner. He's marvelous to be around. And next to him, I sit at the dinner table next to him, and I just kind of sit there. He's three remarks ahead of me, and I can't think of one good one-liner to give. And so I be silent. And the same thing happens in class. So I think we ought to concentrate on the characteristics of the instructional conversation and then tailor the use of the media and all these other things, our expectations of students around that.
Yes, Steve?
Hi, my name is Fambos from Cyprus. I have a couple of comments. I think if we accept that interaction is the fundamental process for learning, then the distinct characteristic between the online and the traditional has to do with the fact that most of the online learning is text-based. Mm-hmm. And that's why the discourse path that the gentleman over there raised is unique, because in a face-to-face situation, we know we can interact with people without even expressing voice, noise, or whatever. I mean, we can look around in the classroom, see a confused face, and we get feedback instantly, and we can make an adjustment or give another example. Unfortunately, or fortunately, in the online environment, the only way to know that people, the only way to interact, is if there is an exchange of some form of text. Because there is some video conferencing and audio, but unfortunately, the majority is text-based. So that's where I think the tricky part becomes. And not just language, as David mentioned earlier, but a lot of other issues have to do with sociolinguistic approaches and all the other issues involved. So, I mean, and I also agree with the fact that, in the future, even beginning now, if you are not able to learn online, then you'll be out of luck, as was mentioned by John. The thing, though, is that the same with traditional face-to-face teaching. Traditional classrooms are appropriate for some kinds of learners, more appropriate than speech, and so is online learning. The traditional classroom is appropriate or more appropriate for some kinds of contents and instructional objectives, and probably so goes for the online and so on, so and for teachers and for everything. So it all depends. I mean, there is not one magic thing for the online that is going to fix it all. So there's some ideas. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Lots of hands.
Hi, Gary Harry from the University of Northern Iowa. John, in your book with Linda Darling Hammond, you talk about the massive impact of a high-quality teacher on the outcomes of students. And I hear us talking a lot about individualizing for the student and focusing on those learning characteristics, but there's a whole lot of people out there who are charged with creating these environments who aren't really trained to do that. And what do you see as needs to be in place in order to assist these people? You know, we have, our campus has an extensive online learning environment, and I can go over there and they can talk to me about what you need to have interactivity. But when you're talking about mass individualization, if I was to say that to our instructional designers, I'm instructional designers, say to myself, I'd go, really? There's nothing in my, aside from learning how to do the individualized learning contracts when I went to my TV training a long time ago, what needs to be in place in order to help people to do the things that you're all talking about?
So, from my experience, co-design process. So rather than just talking to them, here's what I want, and then they assimilate it to what they know, it really is a co-design. So it will take some more time to work with someone who has the expertise in technology and someone who really has the expertise in teaching, and someone, ideally a student, who knows what it's like to be a learner. But you start to bring those together and collaboratively create something that's different than what anybody would have done by itself. But that works better for me than talking.
Mm-hmm. And I also have several responses to going all the way back to this part of the thread and all the way through. And that is that, you know, I'm uncomfortable with this identification of, well, we do 80 to 97% of our learning informally, and then we have school. And this is a pervasive model in the minds of students and teachers. But why do we have that? Is that necessary? Do we need, you know, I'm very interested in the technology and the design of technology to support learning. But we don't have to really wait until all those things are in place. Just like we didn't have to stay within the four walls of the classroom, we never had to do that. And some people went outside. And so we don't have to stay within the confines of the technology that the university supports or the whatever environment you teach in, if it's K-12. There's still the whole world. There's still you don't have to restrict yourself as a learner or as a teacher to some small environment. The whole world is there for learning.
You want to respond to that, John?
Yeah, I think building on that, I keep thinking it really is important for us to differentiate what we want to do in courses and how we want to prepare people for everyday work. And there's almost a tension that we see here where we talk about, oh, people have learning styles, and we want to accommodate them. And so some of them may be not to participate very much for a lot of different reasons. But now once these people are out in the workforce, if they're going to Boeing, and they're going to be, that all that work is online across multinational companies, and if you've never participated online, now suddenly you have to. So in part, we owe it to our students to help them kind of increase their courage spans, to kind of get out of their comfort zone for a bit. So it's kind of a trade-off between, yes, I want to see what you're, you know, I want to accommodate your learning style, of course, but please keep in mind that for the broader world, we're doing you a favor. We help you to move out of it, too. And I've started to do that with my grad students, with a lot of Asian people who don't speak. And we had a really great breakthrough last semester where they started to say, well, I don't, because as soon as I start talking, if I could show you the eyes of everybody else in class, it's just, oh, no, here's this accent again and all that. And then what people do is just always say, good, good, and move on if I do talk. And so they said, I really want to be really criticized, you know, for my ideas, but I want to be I have to be listened to by people. So kind of bringing up that whole thing of helping them get out of this fear of talking, but mainly it's because of how we, as non-native, or as native speakers, respond to that, either online or not online. So.
And then one more little point that was in response to what you said about the conversation. I love the idea of the conversation, but again, a conversation doesn't have to be, as he said, it doesn't have to just be text-based.
Exactly.
Even if that's the only form of conversation that's supported by the software that we are given to use, you can have all kinds of other conversations. I myself am a painter, so there are a lot of artists in online classes, and they may have other ways of expressing. Just as an example, they're part of the conversation. So I would say it's important to not be restricted by the software or the environment, but to create an open environment where people can participate in the conversation in whatever way.
I think sometimes we think that technology is going to open up for us this world, but what we do is we end up taking the economic or the financial argument and we try to reach the mass audience and forget what the instruction was about.
Yeah.
I have a couple more requests, but I'd like to give priority to those who want to reflect on this particular issue that we are right now discussing. Is that your case, Dia?
Yeah, I have two practical things. The first is that I think we shouldn't forget that for almost 15 years in our life, we are in face-to-face instruction. You know, and then suddenly we go to online instruction, which is really completely different. You know, if we fail in online instruction, I think that may be very disastrous for our lifelong learning. Because, you know, that suddenly we think, okay, that mode is not for us. You know, I can't do that. That's the first thing. So I think that's a very important responsibility for us working in distance education. My second observation is also very practical, and that is, get your faculty and yourself to do online courses. You know, not to teach them only, but to do them. And do a course in Spanish, you know, then you can see how it is if you are a student, because we are all talking. I would like to do some research here. How many people really did a distance education course, or let's say two distance education courses? And maybe it's not more than half of you. I did it before, you know, and I looked at it and it was depressing. The Open University UK, for instance, makes it compulsory to do two online courses if you want to be a designer or an instructor, and I think that's very good.
We don't want to embarrass the audience.
No, that's why I don't ask questions.